If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We've got one of our favourite guests here, Mr. Bob McCoskrie. Good morning, Bob.
Morning, Rodney. Always good to be on the show.
Oh, it's lovely to have you. I can't tell you how lovely it is to have you. Bob runs Family First, set it up. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, Bob, I imagine everyone puts the R in your name in the wrong place.
You know, one of the interesting things is that even when I send out media releases where all reporters just have to do is copy and paste, they still get it wrong. It's still McCoskrie or McCroskrie or, yeah, it's quite interesting. So I just give up. I actually, my wife's maiden name was Wood. And so often when I book restaurants, I just book them under Wood because nobody asks how to spell it. It's just a lot easier.
For listeners, it's Coskrie. So yeah, C-O-S-K-R-I-E. And my whole life, I always thought it was Coskrie.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is. And you look at it, it's one of those great things of pattern recognition. And I look at it and I always see the R in the wrong place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you just feel that. Tell us about Family First.
Well, back in 2006, when I was doing media as you're doing now, Rodney, it was kind of the roles reversed. I was the interviewer and you were the interviewee. You were in Parliament. I was hosting a nationwide breakfast program on the Rima Broadcasting Network and doing some television interviews as well on Shine TV, which is on Sky. In fact, I think you came into our studio once in an election build-up as a leader. And during those 4 years that I was doing that, I often struggled. I never struggled to find left-wing, liberal, nutty commentators. But sometimes I struggled to find, apart from your good self, and apart from at that time, the Maxim Institute were very strong, and you know, Muriel Newman was in Parliament. There was some calibre there in Parliament, but we always struggled to get a sort of reasonable right wing conservative voice, especially in the social conservative area. And so when the chapter at REMA came to an end, which wasn't of my design, but it just happened, I thought we need to continue to speak up. We need to push back. Because remember, at that time, 2006, that was Helen Clark in full flight.
Oh, full flight.
Yeah. Decriminalisation, prostitution, civil unions, anti-smacking law. So it was all go. So, yeah, set up Family First with a cheque of $3,000, had no idea what was going to happen, where it would head. 18 years later, we've got about 8 staff, half full-time, half part-time, and we've, you know, been part of some major social debates, and we've just taken on an ex-National MP, Simon O'Connor, and we now have a chat show every Monday night with people of high calibre like yourself and Peter Williams, and really, I think things have pivoted slightly. When I first started, I was able to get a lot of media traction. They actually wanted to talk to me and listen to me, even if they didn't, even if they disagreed. But around 2013-14, which was when the gay marriage debate was, I effectively got cancelled. They didn't like the fact that we spoke up for traditional marriage. And so things started to cool off. And then by the time we got to the abortion debate and then the euthanasia debate and then and winning the cannabis referendum, that was just it. They were livid. And the phone hasn't rung basically since that. And as you know, the state spent 10 years getting us deregistered as a charity because they believe that speaking up for the traditional family and for traditional marriage has no public benefit. But if you speak up for human rights, aka anything woke, or environmentalism, you immediately get a tick and become a charity. So Helen Clark Foundation, Drug Foundation, Child Poverty Action Group, they're all
Rainbow,
charities.
Rainbow Youth.
So, you know, they're all charities, but we're not. But if anything, it shows just where the culture is heading. So, and so because the media has lost its balance and therefore lost its trust, you've got these wonderful networks like RCR springing up out of nowhere.
Yes. And the platform.
Yeah, and it's great. And we're trying to fill that space as well with...
you do a lot of media work, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how to ask this. I'm not trying to be rude, but it's just interesting. Do you find it fruitful? Do you find it working?
Well, I'm sometimes very surprised by the amount of engagement that we get, you know, pleasantly so. To give you one example, in the lead up to the election last year, we, on Straight Talk, we hosted the leader of the ACT Party, David Seymour, and he gave probably one of his worst performances. He totally misread the crowd. He was on a social conservative platform, and he basically abused us and belittled us and mocked us and
called you a liar.
Yeah, that's right. He said, "How can you? I don't know how you can smile when you're lying." We had 50,000 views of that, I think, on Facebook, and I'm trying to remember
about 100 of them were me because I could not believe it.
And look, the polling for ACT actually tanked after that interview. Now, no decent political commentator has actually picked that up, or if they have picked it up, they don't want to admit it. And as a result, we've got a three-headed coalition. And some people may say, well, that's a good thing. I'll leave that to the voter to decide.
What was interesting about that interview is it did go for New Zealand viral. And it would be seen, because I know a little about how ACT used to be, and I know the ACT voters were heavily engaged in politics. And, of course, if your leader is on some show, you're going to watch it, or you're going to click on a viral clip of it. Whereas if you're a National Labour voter, you're sort of more set in your ways and you don't particularly need to follow politics. You're going to vote National, you're going to vote Labour. ACT voters are more into it.
Yeah.
And potential voters. And I saw that and I thought, that's going to kill them.
Hmm.
And ACT had more money than they've ever had, and that one slip. And you can't ever win as a politician by abusing someone. It just turns people off. You can sort of make fun, if it's in good humour, of a political opponent.
Yeah.
But, and of course, a whole lot of people watching it, including ACT voters, when I was the leader of ACT, it was 50% conservative.
Yeah.
MPs and members and voters. And so there were 50% liberal, and it was always liberal in the sense of whatever goes. It was always a bit of a balancing act. And it seemed to me that David Seymour has made a decision. And of course, he's a younger generation. He's made the decision to go for the woke crowd, and particularly with his campaign in Tamaki, where the campaign was based on abortion rights, which seemed ridiculous to me, given that it's open slather on the unborn. I can't imagine what you could possibly do more to make abortion more readily available. And yet that was Brooke Van Velden. Van Velden's campaign. Parliament's loss and your gain with Simon O'Connor. But it's just, anyway, I think he's made that decision to sort of abandon the Conservatives, and that's a big chunk of rural New Zealand, and gone for the urban yuppie, because maybe that's who he feels comfortable with. I don't know. I can't read his mind. But it was a shocking moment in the campaign. And you're quite right to claim the credit, if you like, for a moment in the election campaign where ACT tanked and opened the door to New Zealand First.
Yeah, I just had a look at our stats. There's about 75,000 views on YouTube and our Facebook page of that particular interview, and that's a significant one when you take into it. Even with your 10 watches, that's still a lot of groups and families
and,
watching.
And when you're polling 7%, 8%, 9%, that's a big chunk of your vote.
Well, I think as a politician, you also figure out who's your audience and what is going to scratch their itch. And he seemed to come on wanting to infect it. And we suspected that already because of the strategy of targeting Tamaki. And I mean, that was one of the questions, the Tamaki seat, which is a, you know, has always been a national stronghold. And that was a question we asked him. We said, well, why aren't you putting up a strong candidate like Brooke in a seat like Auckland and tip over Chloe or, you know, Green MP? You know, we said it's because you don't like social conservatism. Well, that set him off as well. And yet, if you look at his voting record, and I think that's what people realised is they thought the ACT Party was still the old ACT Party with social conservatives in it. They may be in it now, but they're certainly not voting that way. You know, they do have some good policy. Obviously, we support the three strikes policy. In fact, credit to the ACT Party, yourself, your good self, voted against that ridiculous anti-smacking law, which has done absolutely nothing but virtue signal. And it was John Boscawen, the ACT MP, who put up the a possible amendment after the referendum, when 87% of New Zealanders who voted said, you know, ditch the law. And John Boscawen put up the referendum and John Key whipped his National Party to vote against it, even though it was a good middle ground, you know, and actually what National had been campaigning on before they were told to vote for it by John Key. So, yeah, I've always been disappointed with John Key on that particular issue. I think he totally undid his principles by rejecting the referendum, the voice of the people, and yet and then whipping his parliament, whipping, pardon the pun, for an anti-smacking bill, but that's the term you use for parliament, don't you? Whipping your caucus.
Yes.
You know, whipping them to vote for the bill that they'd campaigned against. And
have you read Amy Brooks' book, The 100 Days, Claiming Back New Zealand?
Yes, a while back, because it's been out for so long, but Amy has written some excellent stuff.
Well, I just interviewed her, and it's that idea of the 100 days where legislation has to wait 100 days for the Governor-General's signature.
Right.
And in that 100 days, if enough people are annoyed by that legislation, they can force a referendum. I just think that was wonderful because they wouldn't have had a chance with so much legislation in New Zealand if you actually had the opportunity to stop it in its tracks, if there was sufficient action against it. Anti-smacking would never have seen the light of day because the New Zealand people did not want it.
No. And that's why it's so hard to get referendums, because you've got to get, for a citizens-initiated referendum, you've got to get 10% of the population to sign a petition. Now, that's huge. Around 300,000 in terms of the voting public. It's probably 350 now. That is a massive work. I mean, Larry Baldock led a lot of that charge, and credit to him for doing that. I see he's standing for Tauranga Council again. Good on him. Good luck.
Good on him.
but he, you know, 350,000, and then you get it on the referendum, and of course, the politicians, even though the Hansard record says that, which is the parliamentary record, says that they would expect that if a citizens-initiated referendum actually makes it and there's a response, you know, a strong majority one way or the other, the government will respect it. Well, the government didn't respect the anti-smacking one.
No.
The only ones they respect are their own ones. And, of course, the most recent referendums we've had have been on euthanasia and cannabis, and there was that one before about the flag. So it seems like if the government comes up with a referendum, they'll accept the voice of the people. But if the citizens come up with a referendum, they'll ignore it. And I think that's a shocking situation. So, yeah, I agree with what Amy is saying. I think if if enough groundswell can be gained to reject a law, the politicians need to listen. But the problem is the politicians will never admit that they made a mistake. Mm. And that will be just sort of sideswiping onto another topic. That'll be the problem with the conversion therapy law, which effectively criminalizes you, Rodney, for affirming your daughters as being girls. If you know, you could be guilty of conversion therapy if you say, well, you may think you're a boy, but you're not.
How unbelievably ill is that?
And I think especially in the light of the new research coming out, on the harms of transitioning and the harms of puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and social transitioning being built on shonky science and activist groups. And yet we have a law that criminalizes you if you act in the best interests of the child. And every politician, apart from those brave seven or eight that voted against it, which includes our very good Simon O'Connor, should hang their head in shame for voting in a law like that.
Just for listeners, so if your son comes home from school and says, "Dad, I think I'm gay," or "Dad, I want to be a girl," and you say, "Well, hang on, son, we want to talk this through a little bit, and are you sure?" and all the rest of it, you're liable. Are you criminally liable? And the punishment is quite savage, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, 3 years prison for parents, 5 years for professionals.
If you take them to your local minister and say, you know, here's Johnny, just have a little counselling of him.
Mm.
3 years jail for you, 5 year for the minister potentially. However, if you're in the school advocating for them to transition.
Oh, yeah.
Or express their gayness.
Yeah.
Hunky-dory.
Well, conversion therapy is still legal in New Zealand, but it's only if it goes in the direction that the government wants and the activists want. So it's still happening. And Inside Out and Rainbow Youth are practicing conversion therapy in schools. So
as we speak.
Your daughter has told you that she wants to be a boy, and you say, "Well, sorry, honey, you're a girl and you'll always be my daughter and I love you. And are there any other issues that we need to deal with? Are you being bullied? You know, do you just want to play a game of rugby and do you just like doing some of the boys' activities?" But then she pops off to school and Rainbow Youth comes in and says, "No, you can be any one of 112 genders and 200 plus sexualities." And she says to them, "Well, you know, my dad's trying to stop me being who I am." And it's all on. And that's the type of chilling effect. Same for professional counsellors, have that same concern that if someone turns up with unwanted sexuality or gender issues, they are having to tread very carefully, because if the person, even though they may give their consent to have the counselling, if they later on think, "Oh, they were trying to practice conversion therapy on me and not let me be who I am," then that counsellor could be in jail for 5 years. And, I mean, that was one of the shocking things that I thought the ACT, I lobbied the ACT party hard on that particular issue of consent, because what the law says is that the consent of the person has no relevance. So if you or I turn up for counselling for, you know, unwanted sexuality or gender issues, even though we want to change, even though we may want to live our lives according to some principle, then it's irrelevant. The professional or the counsellor or the pastor is still guilty of conversion therapy, irrespective of that consent. And for the ACT party, a libertarian party, to vote for a law that ignores consent, I thought was a shocker.
I wish I could disagree with you. It's like Parliament is declaring that 2 + 2 = 5, isn't it, everywhere you look?
Well, that's what the gay marriage bill did.
Yeah. And also the one that really pulled my chain, because we're diving down this, the one that pulled my chain, I could not believe that ACT voted for this, just by the by, and I actually had to check Hansard because someone was telling me they did on air, and I said, no, ACT would never do that. The idea that you can change your birth certificate.
Hmm. The whole of Parliament. The whole of every Parliament. One of them. 100% of Parliament, 120 MPs voted to make birth certificates.
So we didn't even have the 7 or 8.
No, I think they were whipped, and I must check that actually.
Just for listeners, the law in New Zealand is this. I was born on the 16th of December, 1956.
Gee, you're old, Rodney.
I am. It says there that I'm a boy, right?
Are you sure?
No.
The doctor could have got it wrong.
I can now apply to have that birth certificate changed that I was a girl.
Yeah.
On the 16th of December, 1956, that I was a girl. And I then have a birth certificate saying I was born a girl and therefore I'm a woman.
Yeah.
No one would even know or can know by law that that birth certificate has been changed.
No.
At that point, I'm legally a woman.
Yeah.
120 MPs voted for a lie. Because on the 16th of December, 1956, I was a boy. I was born a boy. The ideology is that the doctor assigned my gender and was mistaken.
Yep. And Rodney, if people don't believe you or me on this, go to birthcertificates.nz. Birthcertificates.nz. And you'll get taken through to our website and you will see what the law says. And here's the interesting thing is that even a 16 or 17 year old, so when your daughter gets to 16, she can change the sex on her birth certificate because the law says that either you get written consent from you, the parent, or you can get a letter of support from a suitably qualified third party, which basically could be Chenille Lal or the local Inside Out coordinator.
Or one of the drag queens reading in the library.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things that happened, so New Zealand first introduced that, what I felt was a reasonable middle ground. I mean, it shows just how crazy our culture has got, but they introduced that toilet bill that said that toilets need to have a clear boys only, girls only for their privacy and protection, and a unisex toilet. So if a biological dude doesn't want to use the boys and the girls don't want him in the girls, he uses the unisex. Problem solved. And the Labour Party MP for those issues, Shannon Halbert, he was on TV, was it on AM show, I think, and he said, how do we check? There is no register of people's gender. Now, I actually tweeted, actually, Shannon, you're wrong. It's called a birth certificate. Your birth certificate is now the gender register. So problem solved. The Labour Party should be supporting that bill because all you do is go back to the gender, to the birth certificate. I mean, that's the mockery that's happening. And you know, we should never have to have this toilet bill, but that's, you know, in the old days, we could all figure out if we were male or female. Now we can't.
Well, I'm upset with the bill that you've got to have a unisex toilet, to be frank.
Oh, exactly.
That's an unfair imposition on people.
The cost.
But interesting, we have a deep biological sense, don't we? We can detect a male and a female, and you can be fooled. You can be fooled often with people from a different ethnicity. But you have a sixth sense. You just look, I mean, no matter how much pink they wear and how much makeup put on, you say, no, that's a bloke. And, so the idea that this guy can't distinguish, he was so stupid in that interview. It was sad, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you forgive him, Bob?
Oh, always, because what I've realised in this whole debate, actually, just before I answer that question, I was listening to Paul on The Breakfast Show, and he was interviewing Catherine Chua and Rachel Stewart. I don't know if you heard that interview, but it was gender conference happening in Wellington.
You're speaking there, right?
Yeah, and the council trying to cancel it. And One interesting thing was that Rachel Stewart, who is gay, said that she believes the whole craziness started when gay marriage was legalized, which is interesting. And even Paul picked it up. He said, well, that's interesting coming from you. And she basically said the problem is that the LGBTQIA plus QWERTY ampersand, you know, have basically not asked for tolerance and acceptance. They're now asking for adherence, and
that's a great word. Yeah, you got to hear.
And
of course, it's divided the
LGB and the T's.
Yeah, because if you're a lesbian, you're highly offended that a man can come into your group and demand access to your meetings and your private places because he declares him a woman.
Yeah.
A woman.
And there's a fascinating case, I don't know if you're aware of, in Australia, which they're awaiting the decision of the judge, and it could be 2 to 3 months yet. And it's in the Human Rights Tribunal, I think, or the lowest court. And it's a case called Tickle versus Giggle.
Oh, yes.
And yes. Giggle is an app which was created by this woman for women, surprisingly. Yes. And so women can talk to each other about women's things. And Tickle is a transgender man who wants to be a woman and so wants to go on the woman's app. And when the Giggle app found out that she was actually a he, said, well, okay, sorry, you can't come in here. This is a female-only app. And so he is suing for, you know, hurt feelings. And so here it is. It's Tickle, which is the transgender guy, versus Giggle, the app. I mean, you know.
You couldn't get a better
announcing
phrase.
That is the next case is Tickle versus Giggle.
And, of course, the other fascinating thing about it is Sal, I don't know her last name.
Yeah, Sal Grover.
Sal Grover is this very sophisticated, elegant, beautiful woman.
Mm.
And Tickle is a sorry excuse for a broken down middle-aged guy with a wig on. Mm. He looks horrid. And, of course, the contrast between the two of them also adds to the – I mean, it's just such a marvelous image of a wonderful woman versus this guy who's confused and in a mess. And there he is. Off he goes. Yes, no, that's a great case. So you forgive them, Bob?
Yeah, because I've understood that from my Christian perspective, my understanding is that we don't battle against people. We don't battle against flesh and blood. We battle against ideologies or principalities and powers. And so for these people, you know, they simply have an ideology that I disagree with, that I don't think comes from truth. It doesn't give them peace. In fact, that's why I think many of them, you know, struggle due to wanting to follow this ideology. And so I feel compassion for them and say, look, you're under a wrong understanding of truth. And you need to take that into account. Otherwise you make people the enemy, you become, you know, bitter and nasty. And I don't think that does anything for our debate. And you know, that actually was one of the things that I tweeted and I'll just read it to you. I tweeted, at no point in New Zealand recent history, and I actually springboarded it off someone else who had tweeted it about their organisation, and I said, at no point in New Zealand recent history has Family First ever attacked a trans meeting or rally. We don't bring loudspeakers to the meeting to drown their speech. We don't bring loud sirens. We don't threaten or intimidate. We don't try to shut down meetings. We challenge ideas and ideologies with research and reasoned debate. So who is attacking whom? Wellington councillors, who is denying the right to free speech? And I think that's the approach we need to have. We need to debate the ideas, and you know, that's why I appreciate.
Well, I'd make an observation, Bob, because in the many years I've known you, I would describe that compassion and forgiveness as your superpower, because there's something quite compelling, or no, it's not the right word. There's something quite amazing in political discourse, particularly these days, when someone doesn't get personal and can always remain their cheerful self, which is what you do in spades. And it is because of that compassion and that forgiveness, which is, even if you weren't, it's a great strategy, but you actually are. So it's very genuine. I'm not suggesting it isn't, but it's a very powerful thing. And when you see it up against the hatred and the violence of the other side that you're dealing with, it's stark, isn't it?
Well, I think I've read some research that there's nothing better for your physical and emotional self than a good belly laugh. And and I think, we need to maintain our sense of humor in this. Often when people send through very disparaging remarks, I just laugh it off. maybe that's a gift that's enabled me to survive in this, and probably you got used to that as well. But sometimes you do. Some people write some stuff and you realize that actually you just laugh. They disagree with you and they really can't argue against you, so they start calling you names. And I always have the philosophy that if someone starts calling you names and labeling you as some type of bigot or phobic, that basically they've lost the argument, and so they're just throwing out some superlatives and it's time to move on. I think we've just got to.
Well, that was your response to David Seymour in that debate, which was quite, when he was starting to abuse you, you just laughed, and he didn't know. I think it sort of upset him to go harder. Tell me, you also, Family First, you do a lot of polling. Why is that?
Well, I think one of our goals is to persuade. With good reason and debate. And so the polling serves two purposes. The polling gives us an understanding of how much work we have to do to get people to understand our viewpoint, rightly or wrongly. And the second thing is that so many issues are being decided in New Zealand by the tyranny of the minority, as the saying. And it's the loudest group shouting the loudest. And therefore, classic example is that, 1% of the 0.8 to 1% of the population doesn't know their gender, or it's different to their biological sex. And yet 99% of women are having to compromise that by being told that, biological dudes can come into their toilet or changing room. Or safe space. And so I think the polling has given reassurance that people who hold our views, yours and mine, Rodney, and others,
and our listeners
on RCR, that actually, we are on the side of common sense and reasonableness. And it's just that the dissenters are a minority group, but with a very loud voice. And sometimes it doesn't always work in our favour. For example, the euthanasia debate, obviously that was lost. The majority decided that they wanted a euthanasia law. I'm disappointed in that. I think maybe we didn't put up our case strong enough, or people believed the other side's argument and were drawn into that. And what it makes you do is, if you realise that you're not bringing people along with you, then you have to go back and think about your argument and how you can make it stronger, and what people aren't understanding. And I mean, look, classic example of this was that in 2018, when the cannabis referendum was first mooted, the vote for the yes was way ahead of the no vote. And I was on Q&A with Chloe Schwarbrick, because I'd just come back from a fact-finding mission in Colorado and Vancouver in Canada, where dope was legal for recreational use. And so I came back with an understanding of what effect it would have on our communities. And so I was in this debate with Chloe. It was a fairly feisty debate. It's still up on YouTube. But what we noticed was that as soon as we entered the debate and started putting the other side in, that the yes vote decreased and the no vote increased. And the people started to understand, not the narrative that was coming out of the media, because the media was very pro-legalizing drugs and still are, but they started to understand the contrary view and the effect it would have on young people and communities. And so,
up until you entered the debate, there was no debate.
No, there wasn't, because nobody would allow it to happen. It was just, we need to legalize. It's the only reasonable thing to do. They'd rush off to the Drug Foundation every time. And Chloe had all the oxygen. And then suddenly we entered the debate. And
tell us, what was the experience? What did you observe in Vancouver and Colorado?
Well, it stinks. There's nothing worse than...
Sorry to interrupt. I went to New York last year to see my son, and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
You're walking down the street, and you couldn't get away from the stench of cannabis. Mm. The funny thing was, I didn't see anyone smoking it. You know, vaping it, the stench of it. Mm. And my son, who walks everywhere in New York, in Manhattan, he didn't notice it.
Mm. You do get used to it. I know. Like,
sorry, I interrupted, but I got such a shock by that.
Oh, I know. And I think for anybody who argues that that they want to legalize cannabis, I would just say go and visit Colorado for a week, or go and visit Vancouver, and you'll come back and you'll immediately vote no, purely based on the smell. And I mean, you've got examples like Thailand decriminalized all drugs and have just announced that they're going to recriminalize them. You've got the state of Oregon who, decriminalized all drugs, and now they're turning it around because it's got that bad. And my argument has always been that the longer this debate goes on, it's in our favor, because the evidence is actually building up. It's a little bit like the transing our children debate. Yes. The longer the debate goes on, the stronger the conservative argument is going to get stronger as well, because the evidence is coming out. And I think that's been one of the difficulties, sorry to go back to the trans debate, but that's been one of the difficulties where we've been arguing against social transitioning and chemicalizing with puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones of children. We've never had the evidence, the really strong evidence to put into the debate. And so we've had to listen to this narrative from the activists saying, a better live son than a dead daughter. You know, if you don't let your child get their way, they're going to kill themselves. And of course, that's been shown to be
the CASS report,
which is the UK report by Dr. CASS, and the NHS, as a result of that report, have banned puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, except in very exceptional circumstances, and for 17 or 18 years, 16, 17-year-olds or 18s. And the WPATH report as well, which is the American group that sets up the guidelines for the world, and which New Zealand uses, and they were shown to even themselves express major concern about chemicalizing and castrating our young people, because they said that children really at that age don't understand the consequences of what they're doing. And they also admitted that parents don't understand the consequences of allowing their children to do it as well. So the evidence is actually on our side, and that's the same with the cannabis debate. The evidence is on our side because parts of the world have legalized it. We just sit back. It's like the canary in the mine, and we just wait for the canary to get out really fast because they understand the consequences of legalizing. If you listen to Chloe and the Drug Foundation and the media, you get this rosy tainted picture of tax money pouring in and regulation, and it's just going to be fantastic. And they fail to mention the massive social costs of addiction and family harm.
I interrupted you on the smell of cannabis because it was such an overpowering thing to me in New York. What else did you observe in Colorado and Vancouver with the
drugs. Well, speaking of the smell, I went to a grow, which is basically that's what they call an area where they have large plantation fields. And the grow was right next to a church. And when the wind blows in the direction from the grow to the church, they have to cancel their church services because it is that overpowering of a stench. It's the skunk smell.
That's a smell off the growing plants, not the manufacturer.
Off the grow, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I saw a petrol station that was, and you have to be American to understand this. It's called Gas and Grass because they call petrol gas. So it's gas and grass. While you're filling up your car with petrol, you go in and buy your cannabis. So you get your drugs while you're filling up with petrol, gas and grass. But I think what I really understood is that when people think about legalizing marijuana, they think about your Woodstock weed or your parents' pot. And that is about 2 to 3, 4% maybe THC, which is the psychoactive substance in marijuana. We're now getting to the point where they are, you can grow, you can smoke weed that can be a lot stronger, around 15%. You can also get vaping and you can get concentrates. And the concentrates, in fact, you can actually get 100% pure THC. Now, the interesting thing was that during the cannabis debate, TV3 actually popped off to a grow in Huntley, and they did some testing of the cannabis to check the THC level, and that THC level they were able to grow under special circumstances was 80% THC. And I remember Andrew Little being interviewed and asked about that, and even he was surprised by that. So this is what people don't understand, is that when you compare the marijuana from Woodstock days compared to the marijuana of today, the marijuana of Woodstock days is a bit like your 1940s vintage car, and the marijuana of today is a bit like your Ferrari that can get to 100 miles an hour in 8 seconds. You know, it's a totally different concept.
And well, it's those numbers. It's like comparing a beer to pure alcohol.
Exactly. Yeah. And so not only have we gone from a beer to a spirit, but even stronger, way past that now.
And the effect on the people?
Well, the problem is that for young people especially, that's a formative time of their brain because it's still forming to about 24 to 25-year-olds. So they effectively can become addicted. And, of course, that's what big marijuana, the industry, wants to do. If you can get a young person addicted, then you've got a client, a customer for life, just like cigarettes. So big marijuana is basically the new big tobacco. In the old days, we were told that tobacco could actually be good for you. Women who were pregnant
smoked it. Doctors said to take it, yeah.
Yeah, we had doctors endorsing certain brands. And then, of course, we realized that it was all lies. Big marijuana are using exactly the same tactics. They're telling us that it's healthy. They're telling us that they won't target it at kids, which they will. And, with gummy bears, which have high THC in it. And so it's all the same tactics because basically you've got the same players who aren't out to give a healthy product. They're out to addict people. But the major problem is that because the THC is so high in what people can now access for marijuana in terms of vaping and in terms of dabs, which is the highly concentrated stuff, you're getting mental illness, which is far more prevalent, and especially psychiatric problems because of the addiction.
And does use go up?
The argument has always been that use will go down. I mean, it's a ridiculous argument. If you legalize something, of course it'll go down. I mean, that's like saying that if we raise the speed limit from 100 to 120, everybody will stay at 100. Everybody pushes against the boundary. We all know that. And the usage in Canada and in the United States has gone up, not only with adult use, but also with child use. So whenever you hear that argument from the likes of the Drug Foundation and Chloe, of course use will go up. It's actually been the illegality of the drug which has kept its usage to a low point. compared to, for example, alcohol and tobacco. And you know, that's a good thing. The illegality sends a message about what we think about it, you know, what the community thinks about it.
And what about this great line that gets pulled out? Oh, prohibition never works.
Well, you only have to compare the three major drugs to see how that's played out. Alcohol usage is around 80%, which of that 20% is problematic usage of alcohol, whereas cannabis usage on a regular basis is less than 10% because of its illegal status. And I mean, you know, what some people are arguing is that we need to legalize also other drugs, hard drugs, cocaine, methamphetamine. I mean, imagine that. Imagine what kind of message that sends. Now, their argument is, well, the problem is that those people are ending up with criminal records and there's a stigma. Well, in fact, that's a healthy stigma. I think that's exactly what we want for harmful things. I think if we were legalizing, if say, for example, right now we were thinking about legalizing alcohol, given what we know about the harm it does and the hospitalizations and the family violence and the drunk driving on the roads, I think we would have totally different laws around it because of that. But drugs, unfortunately, the whole purpose is to get you high and stoned. It's to get away from reality, and that's the harmful aspect of it. Some people say, well, alcohol is already legal, let's legalize cannabis. My response to that is, look, you've already got one massive social harm. Why do we want another one?
What about the argument that cannabis isn't as bad as alcohol?
Yeah, it's only the only way you can make that argument is because of the fact that we have protected people from the actual social fallout of legalizing cannabis. If you want to know whether cannabis is as harmful as alcohol, just go to Colorado and Vancouver and Oregon and New York and Chicago and see the social problems with it and speak with community leaders and youth leaders and families, and you will see that, oh, yeah, if you go down that track, it will be as harmful. The only reason it's not as harmful at the moment is because of its illegal status and the stigma against smoking and using not only cannabis, but all drugs. And I mean, one of the other arguments, of course, Rodney, is that that Māori are particularly impacted by the law. Now, that is true because, unfortunately, Māori are twice as likely to use marijuana compared to other ethnic groups in New Zealand. So therefore, obviously, they're more likely to cross the law. But the argument is not to change the law. The argument is to get more prevention services, more messaging into those communities, and it's also to offer better rehabilitation and addiction services. Now, that is a legitimate argument. We don't have good services to help people who want to get away from drugs. We all know that. And I think the last government put in something like, what did they put into the whole mental health addiction area? It was about $1 billion, wasn't it? And I don't know if really there's been anything shown for it. And, you know, I do laugh at when the National Party puts up its set of goals for the next 3 months and we get to the end of the 3 months and the media says, let's do a check on what they've done in the last 3 months and are they any good? Well, at least they're putting up aspirational goals. All we got for the last 3 years from Labor was a lot of bluster and, you know, promises and a lot of spending, which I didn't see a lot of fruit from.
My poor little daughter gets mentioned on the show too much and I always get into trouble for it. But she was sitting in at high school and awaiting us to pick her up. And a poor young student got carted out into a hospital being in critical condition. She'd taken drugs at school.
Wow.
And I was horrified by this. And
and just for the audience, you're the age of your daughter's what, 12?
13.
13. 13. Wow.
and it was her year, I think. And so I looked up what the policy was for the school on drugs. And to be honest, it was quite hard to find. I had to go to the trustees. This is Waikatipu High School. And then they had a policy statement. Oh, my goodness. That got me even more upset because it was, oh, we follow the Drug Foundation's guidance on this.
Yeah.
And it's all about harm minimization.
Yeah.
No judgments, no judginess. Just, no. You know, come and talk to us and we'll give you professional help. Yada, 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 because we don't want to stigmatize you further and all the rest of it.
No, and I don't want to upset their feelings.
I thought, I can't believe this, because it wasn't that long ago that every school in the country had a zero tolerance for drugs, rightly so. This is all about managing drugs in the school. Funny enough, that's not the policy the school followed, because both that student and the supplier of the drug have been suspended. And I think... probably expelled. But when I read this, I mean, when you were a young man age 20 in the year 2000, you couldn't have imagined what you'd be dealing with now.
No, I mean, I before my REMA radio time, I was actually a community youth worker in the local schools in South Auckland. And so I did that for 12 years and set up an organisation that works with at-risk families and goes into schools. And one of my daughters actually worked for the organisation last year. And, you know, some of the stories she brought home were very different in terms, and especially in terms of the violence on the school grounds. But the interesting trend, Rodney, is that whereas most of my clients were male, and we did have a female worker to work with the females, most of the clients were male by far. Now, girls are becoming far more violent. They're using their phones to film it. They're having fights, and they're very violent fights. That has certainly changed. And gee, I wouldn't want to be a teacher. I just think a teacher gets sacked because they won't use the preferred pronouns of a student.
Sacked and deregistered.
Yeah. And same with the teacher. I don't know if you remember the one at Mount Maunganui College where he flicked some headphones out of a kid's ears because the kid was ignoring him. Yeah, and he was suspended, he lost his teaching license as well. I mean, teachers, the official policy is that if you touch a student in any way in a school, there are about 5 forms you have to fill out. So if you break up a fight or if you have to restrain a child. That was the last time I checked, which was a couple of years ago. I think they did slightly amend it, but... the fact of the matter is most teachers just don't get involved. They wait for security there's a woman I know who speaks at a high school. She says if she sees a fight, she actually just goes and locks herself in the classroom, because if she gets involved, it becomes an issue that she's involved. Secondly, she's concerned for her own welfare. The funny thing is she's got 2 strapping young boys. And yet she's, you know, dead scared of the consequences, not only for her own physical safety, but also for her professional safety.
Yes. Mm. Oh, my goodness. It's astonishing. Do you notice, I don't know, as everyone's sick of hearing, I'm a newborn Christian, but I detect that I'm not alone. And I'm noticing... amongst younger parents, this stuff is turning their stomach, what is happening around them for their young children, the world their young children are entering. And they're searching for what's going on, how can we correct it? And I'm amazed how many are looking deeply into Christian, being a Christian, not just going to church, more than that, actually being a Christian. And I think it's like that. It's gone so far. It's so far down that it's not like a weed correct policy. It's some deep loss of value and principle and belief. And just you describing young girls at school fighting, and as you say, the teachers just having to lock themselves in their room and wait for security because they can't touch anyone. It's that sort of stuff that's going on that is making a lot of people question it. Are you picking any of that up, or is it just my little circle?
No, I think there is a turning around, because over the last 10 to 20 years, there's been this grand experiment, which was sort of started off by Helen Clark declaring us as a secular nation and not saying grace, even though the Queen, who was the head of the Anglican Church, was present.
Can I just interrupt again? I was there. I was there. Right. I have never been so embarrassed and ashamed. And what was worse to me was Helen Clark orchestrated on the front steps of Parliament and pushed out Georgina Beyer to greet the Queen, to get the great line, Queen meets Queen. The first transvestite MP in the world meets the Queen. And the Queen, of course, was extremely gracious and shook her hand and was admirable. But you just felt embarrassed. And funny enough, because I was always on the outside, I was at the banquet with the Queen in the furthest possible position I could be. And sitting beside me was Tim Barnett, who Labour declared the first homosexual, open homosexual elected to Parliament. And he was there with his boyfriend. So I was sitting there with Tim, and I said, oh, Tim, you poor thing, you know, you've been overshadowed, because he had been the flavour in the previous Parliament, because he was the first openly homosexual elected New Zealand Parliament. But he was pushed out to the knacker's yard with me, because now we had the real deal on the transvestite. And, of course, poor Georgina Beyer. Now that I'm on this topic, she ended up being pushed out because Helen Clark, Georgina Beyer was actually quite a reasonable, was a very reasonable person, not quite a reasonable, but very reasonable person. And she fell out of, Helen Clark fell out of love with her, and she ended up being shunned by the Labour Party. But yes, getting rid of grace, and then Trevor Mallard getting rid of the prayer, the mention of God and the prayer of Parliament, it is truly disgusting.
Well, that's an interesting thing, Rodney, because, I mean, you weren't Christian at that time, and yet it grated against you that a prayer wasn't.
I had a wonderful Sunday school teacher and a wonderful exemplars in my parents.
Yeah.
Who lived Christian lives.
And I think deep down within us, we've been able to understand the benefits of having those values and principles which have guided us. I mean, Ten Commandments have guided us, whether we've understood them as the Ten Commandments or not, that respect for life, that respect for the role of mum and dad, the role of marriage. And as we've turned away from some of those bedrocks, those anchors, and as church attendance and adherence has decreased, we've seen massive social issues. And I think what you've recognised is that for those who are thinking through and looking at the consequences, they're connecting the dots, and they're understanding that it is this move away, this rejection of the values which have underpinned our culture and have benefited our culture. There's a proverb, not from the Bible, but it says if you pull down a fence, figure out firsthand why it was put up in the first place.
Yes.
And in our culture, we've been pulling down all these fences in the interests of human rights and personal identity, and nobody is actually asking why were those restrictions in place in the first place. You know,
why do all societies have some form of marriage?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That was one of the arguments that we put up, is that cultures have recognized marriage. They don't have any involvement with relationships such as good mates like you and me, or flatmates, but they are interested in a male and a female relationship, because from that the consequences children, and we understand that the best environment for children to be raised is where it's the biological parents committed to each other and committed to raising that child. Doesn't always happen, not always perfect, because humans are involved, but that's the model that we've been given. And for those who aren't in that situation, we need to give additional support. But we've rejected that and said, oh, that's just a old idea. You often hear, we need to change this law because it's from so long ago. We need to change the drugs law because it's from 1950. Well, if anything, drugs have not got better. Drugs have got worse and more harmful and stronger. And but that's kind of the view. So I'm happy to be on the right side of history in terms of the values, and the right side of truth as well. And I think because people are seeing the cultural breakdown and the societal problems, as you have, you're connecting the dots. So no, I don't think you're alone. Mm. One of the things we have done in Family First is that even though we have a Christian DNA, and I'm Christian, and our board members and staff are Christian, you will not see a lot of evidence of that in our publications and media, etc. We don't sort of, you know, throw out a Bible verse as a punch, because my view is that if you need to pull out a Bible verse to try and justify what you're saying, go back and work on your argument, because to the audience, they will not accept the biblical verse. They will say, well, that's just from the Bible. That's just your opinion. And so we've got to win the debate with good reason and science and biology and truth, which, of course, is all backed up by scriptural truth. But we don't need to say that. We can just argue it based on the facts. And so, you know, that's where the example of that, of course, was the cannabis debate, where we brought in science and reasoning.
Did you ever meet Patricia Bartlett?
No, heard about her. And, it was a very different world because, of course, we didn't have social media and, you know, it was a printed paper, so they did have some coverage. Did you meet her?
Yes.
Mm.
I've told this story once on air, but I'll tell it again because it was so shocking to me. I turned up to university in 1975 at the University of Canterbury. And funnily enough, Peter Dunn, who went on to become an MP and Labour minister and then form his own party, was campaigning and was president of the Students' Association, literally on the price of sausage rolls in the cafeteria. And I remember the first week that I was in university, I couldn't believe it. I didn't know anyone that had been to university. And so I did everything. I went along to everything. And then after that week, I never went to another thing. Because I just got on. I loved university so much. But what I loved was the lectures, the lab work, and the library. The carry-on I couldn't stand after this week. And partly it was the experience I'm about to tell. And I went along to the Dame Naya Marsh Theatre to hear Patricia Bartlett speak. And I've never been good in crowds, and I went utterly on my own. And this diminutive nun walked out onto the stage and made an argument against Playboys. And I thought she was completely wrong. I was 18.
Yeah.
And her argument was that, you know, a man reading a Playboy beside his bed was disrespecting his wife.
Yeah.
And I remember that point, and disrespecting his wife and causing, you know, marriage breakdown.
Yeah.
The crowd of students hooted at her, yelled at her, screamed at her, made jokes at her, called her names, threw condoms at her. In my life, I've never been so appalled and sickened at such behavior.
Mm.
But to this day, actually, I've never seen a braver, more admirable thing than this little old lady in a nun's habit coming to a university and speaking up against pornography, which, you know, was pretty tame playboys with bare breasts, I would guess. Of course, now she would be not allowed and she'd be violently attacked. She'd be physically assaulted. She was never, funnily enough, and this is the, you know, 1975, never in physical danger. But she was so right.
she was a Posy Parker of that, wasn't she?
Yes. And I've never forgotten it. I've never forgotten the bravery. And it's that one thing that possibly because of her faith, she knew that there'd be a young man sitting there quietly thinking she was wrong, but being impressed by her bravery and years later recognizing the righteousness of her cause. And she was amazing. And she just was the butt of everyone's jokes, wasn't she? And that, well, you probably too, you're too young. But she was just, you know, cannon fodder for the media. Oh, Patricia Bartlett complaining about this, Patricia Bartlett complaining about that. Oh, my goodness, how far we've become. Bob, your webpage, Family First, is a must look, full of resources for people who are interested in the issues of the day and an expose. It was from you that I first learned about the issues that my kids would be confronting in school. I did not believe it. I thought Bob's gone and got this from America, and in America they're clearly nutty. And then I made an investigation at my local school. Oh my goodness, you were 100% right. And if anything, we're far further down the hole of indoctrinating our kids in perversion than America is. I thank you for that. For people wanting to catch up with your media, you got Monday night at 8 o'clock live.
Yep.
You've got Pulse Point.
Yeah, that's our great episode. Simon does a 8 a.m. on Tuesday morning live conversation about issues, which has just started, which is called Solid Ground. And I do the McBlogs, which are throughout the week and on various commentary. In fact, you've just reminded me I need to reissue my explanation about why everybody should avoid Pink Shirt Day and that what it pretends to be is nothing
this about Friday.
What it really is.
This Friday. Bob, always a pleasure. Family First, go and have a look at their webpage. Great material. Watch McBlob, watch Simon O'Connor. Great stuff. Bob was a great supporter of Reality Check Radio when we were down, still is. Always willing to come on. I love our conversations, Bob, because you educate me. I love going on your sessions on a Monday because I actually get a little bit schooled. And you'll notice that I'm starting to get the hang of it and I'm starting to sort of get a bit controversial because
a lot of your
guests are a bit wimpy.
They're trying to be polite, but I was just going to say to you, I'll be catching up with you on Monday night, so I better start thinking of some controversial topics, eh?
Right, you take care, Bob. Always a pleasure.
Okay. All good. Thanks, Rodney.
That was Bob McCroskey, Family First. Great guy. I've known him 30 years, I guess. We used to bang heads, and now I agree with him. Shows you how he changes. No, it's me. And go to their webpage. It's a great resource. And do watch some of their shows. They're very, very informative and enjoyable. You can send me a text at 2057. Email me inbox at realitycheck.radio. You've been real talking with Rodney Hyde on realitycheck.radio.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.